What I want to talk about today is the notion of authenticity, which very roughly speaking could be understood as like being oneself. It's a problematic notion in all sorts of ways. It can sound just like a daft notion because, you know, how hard can it be yourself? If I could give you should I do a demonstration now? There we are, I just did it. Doesn't sound that hard. So it can't mean the notion that you there might be somebody to worry about being yourself, you know, has to be given some other kind of sense. And what we find in the history of the discussion of the idea of authenticity are that there are a few sort of recurrent themes, but one which is pretty well a constant is the idea that in some way or other, being, if you like, socialized is a problem. So that in some way or other, if you like, the rest of you pose a kind of threat to my authenticity. In some way, becoming a member of society threatens me with a certain kind of loss of self. And I suppose the idea of conformism is the obvious word to use for this. So that the worry that in some sense or other, there's this danger embodied in my relationship to the rest of my society, that in some way it's going to compromise myself. I'm going to lose myself in some sense. I'm going to fail to be myself by virtue of this, my involvement with the rest of you. So for that reason, you'll find in the figures who form, if you like, the history of the discussion of authenticity, certain characteristic and slightly offensive expressions, like Nietzsche talking about the herd, Kierkegaard talking about the crowd, and as you'll see in a moment, Heidegger talking about the they. So these expressions which are referring in some way to, if you like, broader society as in some kind, representing in some way a kind of menace to me and my authenticity. But it's a problematic notion, and one way of thinking about what's problematic about it is just to take a couple of minutes to think about the history of the idea. As we'll see that when we look at some of Heidegger's ideas about it, there are in some respects in which it seems quite an ancient idea, but there are other respects in which it seems quite a modern, a distinctively modern concern. So, for instance, there seems to have been an emergence of this sense of a worry about whether one is being oneself that emerges in ideas of thinkers such as people like Hobbes and Locke, people who were involved in what's known as, you know, the social contract theories. Because what they seem to suggest is that in a way society is somehow artificial. So my involvement with you is something which I might choose to take up or not. That I'm in some sense an autonomous human being, and I might get involved with other people, I might have social relations with other people, but I might not, I might choose not to. So in a sense, society, my social relations don't really seem to be, as were natural to me, there's things that I can either take on or choose not to. That kind of theme is given a particular kind of twist when you get into the phase of the history of ideas, sometimes called the counter-enlightenment phase, when you get people like Rousseau coming onto the scene. Rousseau would be one of the first people who suggests that perhaps modern society is distinctively alienating, if you like. Modern society in particular imposes upon us, as he puts it, corrupted needs, unnatural needs. It makes us worry about, it gives us concerns that aren't really natural to us. So to give it some sort of concrete form, we go run around worrying about how we're seen in the eyes of others, or we worry about having the fanciest and most admirable bit of luxury goods. So we all want to have our iPhone 4 or whatever it is, for the sake of how we're perceived by one another. And Rousseau's suggestion is that there's something distinctive about modern society in imposing these kinds of distorted needs on us. So he talks about the way in which in societies such as ours, the chains that we're principally subject to are psychological chains, and that they derive from the kind of society that we live in. So again, you've got this notion that in some way I'm losing my integrity, I'm losing myself by virtue of the way in which I'm involved with my society. And you can also, in a way, see something like that kind of notion also emerging in ideas in Kant as well. So he has a very important discussion of the way in which for us to act genuinely morally and on our own behalf, the only laws we can really be following have to be laws that we impose upon ourselves. So he has an argument against what's sometimes called divine command ethics. The notion that what's right is what God tells you to do. What Kant, Kant responds to this by saying that in a way that seems somehow beneath our dignity, that it's somehow subhuman to, as it were, just be doing, in a way essentially just be obeying orders. So that if we truly are capable of acting morally and acting on our own behalf, it has to be on the basis of as it were, not orders that come from somebody else, but orders which in some way come from within ourselves. Having said that, it doesn't take long for these kinds of ideas of integrity, of authenticity, to start looking problematic. Because in all sorts of ways, you might say, our social existence is not artificial. It's not some kind of external add-on in the way that somebody like a Hobbes or a Locke thought of. Now, we can see that in the emergence of modern disciplines like sociology, certain twists in history, the view that in some sense we are fundamentally, first of all, autonomous agents who might then subsequently decide to have a few social relations starts to sound increasingly implausible. It sounds fantastical. It sounds like an idea from a bygone era when perhaps we, which might be associated with ideas about, say, souls which somehow transcend or don't really belong to our earthly realm. So the idea that human beings are essentially autonomous agents who may or may not take up social relations has become more and more fanciful sounding. It sounds like metaphysics in that bad sense, sort of funny ideas that don't correspond to how we actually find ourselves and how we actually live. So the notion that we're essentially social beings and that our social lives make us what we are is an idea that you find sort of as we're shot through the humanities and in its modern forms, but in a sense it defines subjects like sociology and certain kinds of psychology. You can also worry that, in a way, that the attitude towards socialization, social relations, that the picture I sketched before involved, it underestimates the importance and value of socialization. I'm sure there's a few people in this room who have had children. And one thing you become pretty aware of when you have children is that socialization is a bloody good thing. And you better make sure they get socialized. Because if you send them out there, with their, as were, their unreconstructed wild desires and insistences, there's going to be trouble. And one of the things you're trying to do is you're trying to, as were, cultivate a certain kind of care for other human beings, a certain kind of self-awareness, and so forth. And all of these processes seem to involve a certain kind of socialization of a thoroughly good form. Now, I mean, there are some people who've had rather mixed feelings about it. So, somebody like a Freud had rather mixed feelings about it. But even then, I think you can see within his work a certain recognition of the importance of socialization. So the idea that in some sense you should be left to express your certainly if it was something like your own primal urges that you're somehow born with, then that starts to look like a rather unappealing picture of authenticity, of being yourself. In some respects, we really don't want people to be themselves. We want them to learn what's involved in treating other people in reasonable ways, and in a sense, it's a kind of socialization. And another worry that you might have is that, I suppose in a way it's related to the previous point, one of the reasons why you want to socialize your children in a way is to make it possible for them to do things like enjoy friendships and enjoy love with other people. A certain kind of accommodation towards other people seems to be necessary for those, if you like, really sort of fundamental goods that we value. And one of the worries that you might have about authenticity, viewed as some kind of rejection of the social, rejection of socialization, is that it starts looking like the authentic person is going to be somebody who has to reject things like friendship, all the, if you like, the patterns of life which are thoroughly socialized. And they start looking like increasingly sort of eccentric figures. So, you know, they have to be the person who's riding that unicycle down the road. They have to be, in some way, there seems something almost contrived and a little sort of perverse, sort of under-motivated. It doesn't seem to be a life that seems to have a worth in itself beyond the fact that it's not the social. So another worry you might have about the idea of authenticity is that there's a certain, it seems to require a certain kind of perverse eccentricity from us. So that's not very appealing either. So what is it that we're really after when we look for authenticity, when we're striving to be ourselves? And in a way, this is these kinds of worries, you can see them expressed in, if you like, if we just go back to the historical framework, in some later ideas about just what it would be to be yourself. So within Romanticism, you've got a certain vision of being yourself is almost creating yourself from nothing. You've got this vision of the artist, as it were, so willing themselves into existence. Or within the philosophies, for instance, if you think about somebody like Jean-Paul Sartre, playing some kind of role in his thinking seems to be the idea that the authentic person is the person who performs some kind of radical choice of their life project. They're in some way standing apart from the, as were the proposals of society, and radically choosing themselves in some way. Now, the worries about both of those kinds of responses is that in a way it seems to be a bit kind of arbitrary. You know, on what basis do you choose? Why do you choose that life? Is there any value in that life? Or is it just the mere fact you've chosen it? Is that in itself somehow valuable? Or you have that vision of the artist creating from nothing. Well, certain sort of yearning for a kind of basis. Otherwise, it seems kind of arbitrary. And certainly you have this kind of worry in when people looked at Kant. So you had this vision in Kant of the only laws in which you can follow and, as it were, be acting on your own behalf, be acting truly autonomously, would be laws you give yourself. But where do these laws come from? What sort of basis can you give? And he himself thought that, in a way, rationality would, reason itself would fix what these laws would be. But notoriously, since Kant wrote, there's always been this worry that the idea of reason itself seems too thin. So what content can we give to these laws we're supposedly going to give ourselves? Now, what I want to do in the rest of the talk is just to have a little look at some ideas that one particular thinker offered, and that's Martin Heidegger. And he's controversial in all sorts of ways, and he's extremely difficult to read in all sorts of ways. And what I'll offer would very much just be one way of looking at what he's doing, you know. And whether it's an accurate reflection of what he does, I don't know. But it looks to me as if that's what's going on, and it seems to make sense of what he's talking about. Now, Heidegger is, if you look at the history of the discussion of authenticity, Heidegger sort of comes between Nietzsche and Sartre, and you could see there's a very visible shaping influence on Sartre coming from Heidegger. It's pretty clear that much of the framework within which somebody like Sartre works is set by Heidegger. And Sartre's become he's a much better known thinker in a lot of respects than Heidegger. But for my money, I feel that, in a way, Heidegger's the more interesting figure. And, for instance, I think he doesn't end up suggesting that authenticity amounts to some kind of radical self-choice in the way that Sartre does. But we look at what he has to say. So one of the things you find in Heidegger straight away is that worry about a certain kind of worry about conformism and socialization. So that familiar idea that you get in other philosophers who worry about authenticity. So, you know, Nietzsche worries about the herd, Kierkegaard worries about the crowd, Heidegger worries about the they. Yes, this expression, the they. And here are a couple of pretty typical passages. So he worries that when we're inauthentic, when we're not, as we're being ourselves, this is how we are. He says, we take pleasure and enjoy ourselves as they take pleasure. We read, see, and judge about literature and art as they see and judge. Likewise, we shrink back from the great masses as they shrink back. We find shocking what they find shocking. So a nice little twist there when he talks about, we shrink back from the great masses as they shrink back. So even when we think we're being authentic, even when we're reading our Nietzsche and we're talking about the herd and the danger of the crowd, that can also be a form of inauthenticity for Heidegger. Because what's happening there? Well, we're shrinking back from the great masses as they shrink back from the great masses. And he thinks that the way in which he describes how we are in this kind of condition is, he thinks that in this condition, everyone is the other and no one is himself. The they, which answers the question of the who of everyday human beings, which means, who are we in our everyday existence, is the nobody. So, you've got these classic existentialist worries already to very visible within Heidegger. Now, I mentioned one of the difficulties of the idea of authenticity is that it can sound like it's demanding of a certain kind of eccentricity, sort of unmotivated eccentricity. So, and sometimes you do find this in commentators on Heidegger. Hubert Dreyfus, one of the most influential readers of Heidegger, talks about how the authentic person has to engage in marginal practices, for instance, this expression that he uses. I think if we can avoid saying that about Heidegger, it would be good news, because it sounds to me like the authentic are now sounding like rather kooky characters who are engaging in marginal practices, so that they're beginning to look like rather comic figures, it seems to me. And also, I don't think it looks like he doesn't really think that that's what you have to do. So he talks about the ways in which, as he says on the handout, he says that the they is a primordial phenomenon. It belongs to our positive constitution. So in a way, he's saying the they is part of us. It's not as if the they is some artificial add-on in the way that it might have been for somebody like Locke. Instead, our social existence is part of our positive constitution. And he says, authentic being oneself does not rest upon an exceptional condition of the subject, a condition that has been detached from the they. It's rather a modification of the they. So now, what do we do? How do we make sense of this? So in some sense, he wants to say that the they, this threat to our integrity, our being ourselves, is somehow part of our positive constitution. It's not something you can somehow shake off. And one of the worries that people have had about Heidegger when he talks about authenticity is that it almost looks impossible to achieve authenticity. If the they is part of your positive constitution, and the they is in some way a threat to your being yourself, then it looks as if being yourself is not really a possibility. And this is a familiar worry about his ideas. And for that reason, quite a lot of commentators in the past have looked at those bits of Heidegger and think, we just can't do anything with this stuff. We can't make sense of this. But I think there's reason for a bit more patience. And I think if we do that, it also brings out an interesting idea of being oneself. Maybe a little bit different from the one we thought we were going to get, but one that's interesting in itself. He describes the inauthentic as, he talks about their inconstancy. He talks about them being dispersed. So he says things like this. He says that not letting his own most self take action in itself, the inauthentic person is dispersed into the they. So you've got this vision of oneself in some way disintegrating and being sort of swept out into the they. Well, what's that supposed to mean? Well, he says the inauthentic person understands himself in terms of those very closest events and befallings which he encounters, and which thrust themselves upon him in varying ways. In the inconstancy of distraction, he busily loses himself in the object of his concern. Whereas the authentic are, in some sense, they're marked by what he calls constancy. And they stand by themselves, or the authentic person stands by him or herself. So what are we to make of these ideas of constancy and dispersal? Well, here's one suggestion. I think one of the ideas that's driving Heidegger is the idea that when inauthentic, what we do is, as we move through the different contexts in which we live our lives, we adapt to the demands of each of these new contexts. So I'll behave in a certain kind of way here, I'll behave in a certain kind of way at home. I'll behave in a certain way when I meet my mother. I'll behave in a certain way down the pub. I'll behave in a certain way at the match, and so forth. And I think one of the ideas that Heidegger has in mind is that what marks a person's inauthenticity is, in a way, a lack of continuity in me as I move through those different kinds of contexts. So the values that I express in one of those contexts are quite different from the values that I express elsewhere. So suppose my boss is a Pompey fan. The things I'll say to him may not reflect the things I say about Pompey when I'm down at St. Mary's, for instance. So there seems to be, I think one of the ideas that Heidegger is drawing on in this idea of us being dispersed into the they, and as we're falling into the many different activities in which we engage, is that in a way there's not a continuity of outlook on my part as I move through those different contexts. So in some sense or other, and we'll come back to this in a moment, the views I express about Pompey at the match, are they my views? Because the way I talk to my boss when I'm in the office, my actions don't seem to express that view about Pompey. So in what sense is that view my view? If it doesn't actually inform the way in which I act in general, then it starts looking as if I can't really identify that view as my view. It's not a view that I really own, to use an expression that Heidegger uses. The word that's translated as authenticity in Heidegger's case is this word Eigentlichkeit, which means something like ownedness or owning. So his idea is that in some way or other the authentic own themselves in a way that the rest of us don't. Now, I think on the basis of that kind of vision, that in some way or other, the many different contexts in which we live impose a certain kind of challenge to us. And the challenge is, if you like, to live by and express the same kinds of commitments across all of those different contexts. Now, why should that be important? Why should you do that? Well, I think one of the ideas is that, as I've already alluded to, is that if you don't, it looks as if the commitments you do express or the values you do seem to be acting on the basis of are not really truly your own. They just seem to be ones that you're picking up in one context and you're dropping in another. So my view of Pompey doesn't seem to really be my view because it doesn't seem to inform the way in which I act in the rest of my life. So in that sense, it looks like it's not my view. And I think we can begin to get a bit of a feel for some of those ideas by looking at some of the ideas that Heidegger picks up in a way from the history of philosophy. One of the ideas that he talks about, and it's another one of his really problematic ideas, is he talks about the idea of conscience. He talks about the call of conscience. He says, our potentiality for being ourselves is attested by that which is familiar to us as the voice of conscience. So he says, in some way or other, what we call conscience makes, in some way, intimates to us the possibility of being ourselves. But then he goes on to say a very peculiar thing. He says, what does the conscience call to him to whom it appeals? Taken strictly, nothing. Martin, what are you doing? The call asserts nothing, gives no information about world events, has nothing to tell. Conscience discourses solely and constantly in the mode of keeping silence. So this gives you a flavour of what you're up against when you're trying to read this chapter. Now, I think there's an idea of conscience which actually does fit the kind of account that I've been given. So if you look back in the history of philosophy, the idea of conscience is characteristically, it's understood to mean something like the capacity to actually bring to bear in your life, it's normally moral principles which you hold. So if you look at the work of somebody like Thomas Aquinas, there you have a notion of conscience where in one way we have a grasp of general moral principles, but it's another thing altogether to actually bring them to bear in your life. And this is a pretty recognisable phenomenon. So there's always this challenge of, as we're not only knowing what the right thing to do is, but actually doing something about it, actually acting on it. And I think one of the reasons why Heidegger turns to this notion of conscience is because, in a way, That's the kind of challenge that he thinks being oneself is. It's, if one viewed from one perspective, it's, as it were, really bringing to bear the commitments that you have in your life, across the full range of your life. So really what I need to do, if I really feel the way that I say I feel about Pompey, in the way that, you know, when I'm down at St. Mary's, is the first thing I go in when I go and see my boss next day, is I chin him. That's what I've got to do. That's obviously the, as it were, the authentic way of embracing, of really owning that opinion. Or perhaps instead, when I'm down at St. Mary's, I should just sit down and quietly say, well, may the best man win. So either way, if you're like, if those views that I express truly are going to be mine, then they're going to have to be brought to bear across my life more broadly. In a way, Heidegger takes this even, he takes it another step, because not only do you have the idea that, in a way, to be true to oneself, being a matter of, as we're truly believing what you say you believe, and this doesn't have to be, this could be just to myself, you know, do I truly believe what I say to myself, I truly believe? Well, if I do, then it should actually be informing the way in which I live. The further step that he seems to want to take, and I think this is behind the rather odd thing that he says at one point, he talks about having a self as an achievement. So he seems to be suggesting, you know, well, like, not everybody's got one. So this idea that, you know, we must strive to be ourselves, well, in a way, you better have one first. And Heidegger seems to be suggesting maybe we don't all have a self. And I think the idea that he has in mind there is that it's possible to imagine a human life which doesn't seem to be characterized by, if you like, it doesn't seem to illustrate a person having views of their own. They are, as it were, just constantly picking up the values of the different contexts that they find themselves in. So I think Heidegger, in a way, takes it a further step. He's saying, not only do you have to, if you like, to be yourself, not only do you have to bring to bear your beliefs across the range of your life, for all the different contexts, across time, it's another important theme for him. Not only is that necessary if you're to be yourself, but in a way, if somebody doesn't, if somebody is that kind of rather chaotic figure that I've been sort of presenting myself as, you know, has one view in one context, one view in the next, then you start worrying that it's not that they don't bring their beliefs to bear in their lives, but they haven't really got any beliefs. There's nothing you can identify as my beliefs. Because when you look at the life that I'm leading, there doesn't seem to be any basis for thinking that. So in a way, this picks up on the familiar enough thought that you know, somebody expresses some moral view but never seems to act on it. Well, what conclusion do we come to it? Two, well, after a while we think, well, they don't really believe it, do they? They don't really hold that view. So, you know, I keep talking about how I hate Pompey fans. I never do anything about it. So you start thinking, he doesn't really seem to, actually. So it looks like I don't actually possess that belief. And I think one of the things that lies behind some of these most extreme things that Heidegger says, this idea that selfhood is an achievement, having a self is an achievement, I think is this notion that unless there's a certain kind of continuity, a certain kind of consistency in your life across the many different contexts in which you find yourself, then there's no particular reason to think of you as possessing beliefs of your own, of having your own beliefs, having your own commitments, having your own opinions or your own values. So in a sense, having your own values, having your own beliefs and so on, is a certain kind of achievement. And it's only those who live a certain kind of life who actually, if you like, manage to have their own beliefs. And so, you might say, to have, in a way, an outlook of their own, to constitute, as he rather floridly puts it, a self. And I think you can see this idea, in a way, I think it's, you know, it's not a peculiar idea of Heidegger's. I think you can see it in the history of philosophy. So for instance, I think there's something like that idea at work in somebody like Nietzsche, who you know, expresses it in his own inimical way. So Heidegger talks about the feeble windbags who promise without the right to do so. And he talks about the way in which, in order to be able to make promises, you have to be able to impose a certain kind of order on your life. And you can understand that. You know, when I try and get my son, you know, when he was like three years old, you know, I said to him, do you promise that you know, if you, you know, you can have these sweets if you eat up your dinner. And he'll say he promises, but I know he can't really promise. He hasn't got, as well, his life hasn't got the kind of organization required. He can't impose that sort of order on his own life. So in a way, it's a certain kind of achievement to become somebody who's capable of promising. And, you know, I didn't call him a feeble windbag at the time. I'll go back later on and tell him, you know, you used to be a feeble windbag. And here's another tasty line from Nietzsche. He says, you know, one should not at all assume that many humans are people. The person is a relatively isolated fact. And I think, again, what he's getting at there is, again, this idea that a certain kind of, if like, that there is an achievement involved in a being yourself, in the sense that there's an achievement in possessing views of your own, opinions of your own, things, you know, the idea that you can actually understand them as owned. But at the same time, I think, in a way, this is an ancient concern. I think it's one that, and it's, if you like, it's a universal concern. It's this concern, in a way, about whether in your actions you really are expressing views that you really can think of as yours. And you find in Aristotle, for instance, he has a discussion, what he calls the acratic man, which is sometimes it's this idea of, sometimes translated as the incontinent man. It's rather unfortunate translation now. What it basically means, in a way, it's tied up with the idea of weakness of the will. So the person who can't really, isn't really sort of imposing it in their lives, the views that they supposedly express. The views that they express, even perhaps to themselves. So they might be telling themselves, this is what I care dearly about, but the way they live, there's no sign of it. And what Aristotle says about such a person, who, as he puts it, they haven't worked into the living structure of the mind, of their lives, these commitments that they're supposedly claiming as their own. And what do they look like? Well, he says they're like actors, mouthpieces for the sentiments of other people. So I think that although in some respects authenticity is seen as a rather modern concern, I think there's also an ancient side to it. And I think the kind of idea that you find in somebody like a Heidegger is in some respects that ancient notion, that in a way there's a certain achievement in being more than an actor, in being more than the mouthpiece, more than a mouthpiece of the opinions of others, but in some way to have commitments that you really can claim to be your own, and, as it were, beliefs that when you express can be really taken to be your own. So I think I think this is one way in which the idea of authenticity seems very real and very live and still very recognizable for us. In some respects, it doesn't. This vision asks us to in a way step away from some of the earlier discussion. So, for instance, one of the things it doesn't, this notion of authenticity doesn't require, is that you get that unicycle out. It doesn't require that you engage in marginal practices. It could be just a matter of, when you say that I'm really committed to being a good teacher, that be reflected in the way that you actually live. Or when you say that you're committed to your friends, that it actually be manifest in the way in which you live your life. So in this respect, this idea of authenticity doesn't require us to push away the social and forget about our cultural and historical context. What it says is that if amongst the many values and commitments that you absorb from there, if any of those are going to count as truly yours, truly ones you own, then they have to inform your life. So it's not as if you have to somehow conjure up out of your imagination some unique lifestyle that no one's ever lived before. It's just the requirement. Well, just isn't quite the word, because it's going to be hard work, and it's going to be something not everybody achieves. It's going to be making some of those commitments, some of those beliefs, truly your own, and that requires that you live a certain kind of way, that you actually bring those beliefs into your life and live by them. I think I'll probably leave it at that. There we are. Thank you very much.